Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, Joe Biden marks the one-year anniversary of the pandemic. In his first primetime address to the country, the president told Americans that after a year of suffering, better days are coming soon. He promised that all adults would be eligible for the vaccine by May 1st. And he said, we may be able to hold small gatherings to celebrate the 4th of July. The speech came hours after Biden signed a massive $1.9 trillion COVID relief package, his first signature accomplishment 50 days into his presidency. To talk about the speech and how the first 6 weeks have gone for the new administration, I spoke with James Fallows, staff writer at The Atlantic and author of Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America, soon to be an HBO documentary. Jim Fallows, President Biden made his first primetime speech last night. Number one, what did you think of it? Number two, what about the content?
I thought as a speech, it stayed true to the essential quality of effective speech making, which is that the words and the delivery ring true to the speaker. Now, we've all seen examples of people who try to wrap themselves in puffed up oratory and recite things from John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama. And Joe Biden didn't do that. It sounded just like him talking. It was quite plain spoken. It showed the sort of personal empathy that has been both part of his life and part of his political identity. So I thought, as a speech, it is just what you'd like to hear from somebody in that circumstance. Say one other thing about the speech. As you know, Diane, back at the dawn of time, I was a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter when he was in the White House. And there's a category of speech that leaders give when something has gone wrong. When a space shuttle is blown up, when you've been attacked at Pearl Harbor, when there's hundreds of thousands of people who've died in a pandemic. And the formula always for those speeches, when they're going to be good, is number one, you express empathy. You know that people have lost things. You know they've been afraid and hurt. And Joe Biden did that. Number two, you express confidence in the long run, that we've been through hard times before and we can get someplace. And then number three, you offer a plan. So if you have the formula of empathy, confidence, and a plan, I think that's what we did here from Joe Biden's speech. So just as a speech, I thought it was effective.
He sounded so warm and comfortable in his own skin.
It is true. And at previous times in Joe Biden's long career, which you and I have both seen over the decades, there are times when he has aspired to high-flown Kennedy-style oratory, especially early in his career, and the time he got in trouble back in the 1980s when he was having some anecdotes from Neil Kinnock, the British politician. But this sounded like nobody but him, and it sounded authentically like him. So I thought it was the right note for somebody making this first televised address to give.
He was a man I could believe in, someone I certainly don't know personally, but he came across as someone you could speak with, you could talk with. He would understand what you were saying. He came across as believable.
That was my impression as well. And I think the polls seem to indicate that regardless of the outcomes of the previous election, that a larger number of people actually believe and feel comfortable with Joe Biden than once his margin in the election. There was one other thing that struck me about this speech, which was it was sort of the second step in a ceremonial process that we've lacked over the past year of this medical disaster. The first step would have been, I believe, the night before the inauguration. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and her husband, I believe they all were by the Lincoln Memorial at dusk. And there were all these lights going up as sort of commemoration of this incalculable toll of American life. And this was this, and this speech tonight was sort of the second step of that, of one of the symbolic roles of a president, which is marking blows to the nation as Barack Obama did with his Amazing Grace speech in Charleston after the gun massacre there, as George W. Bush did on his September 20th address to Congress after the 9/11 attacks. There's something a president does to mark what we've been through as a people, and that hadn't happened over the previous year. So I thought this was also symbolically important in that way.
Now, tell me your thoughts on the content of what he had to say.
So I thought that the content, it was interesting that it was mainly, you know, within the previous 24 hours, Biden had achieved a really remarkable legislative victory, which we will talk about in a moment. But that was only a minor part of what he was discussing in the speech, interestingly. I think it was mainly the occasion for it was the one-year anniversary of essentially the U.S. going into the tunnel of the pandemic. And a year earlier, Donald Trump had given a very different kind of speech. And so Biden marking what this had meant, recognizing the toll of deaths, but also the fact that there was this plan ahead of saying that something remarkable had been achieved in getting these vaccines ready, you know, over the past 6 months, over the past 7 or 8 weeks. Suddenly there was this dramatic efficiency in getting things spread and distributed. And then Biden saying, we, the government, are doing our best, but we, the American people, are actually all in this together and that we need to all do our part. There was a kind of World War II, the good side of World War II in that way of that there is, we all do our part. And so I thought that was interesting. And then, so he was saying there is hope ahead. There's a tangible marker. Number one, the May dates for having vaccine available for everybody or having people be all qualified who were all adults. The July 4th target of being able to have something like more normal gatherings. And I thought it was also striking that Biden was consistent to his under-promising in hopes of over-delivering approach, of saying that not promising that everything would be normal by July 4th, but there would be something more like a normality by July 4th. And then he talked about economic plans, et cetera, but for a legislative achievement that was as large as it has been, to have it be a relatively minor part of the speech, I thought was significant, again, in this under-promising, over-delivering fashion.
I realize it's going to be a long time before we know, but do you think that that speech could have been the beginning of winning over non-believers?
If we're talking about non-believers in the vaccine, I think, yes, it's a step in that direction. I've thought all along that just if you have day by day, 1 million or 2 million people getting their vaccinations, and week by week, people being able to behave differently because of that. I think a month from now, 2 months from now, there's not going to be the disbeliever faction is going to be much smaller. I'll give you two anecdotal illustrations. One is a week from now, my wife and I are going to do something, my wife Deb, whom you know, are going to do something we haven't done for 15 months, which is to get on an airliner and go see our children and grandchildren, first in Texas and in California, because we've both been vaccinated. We're sort of past the, you know, the second shot time, so we can do that. And that's one anecdote. The other is we were talking with somebody we know in Florida who's been a skeptic of any kind of vaccinations, and she said yesterday, she feels that, you know, she's now signed up for the vaccine because she realized she's not going to be able to live normally if she doesn't get into what everybody else is doing. So I think the speech, so disbelievers about vaccines, I think this is going to be a process. Disbelievers in Biden and this new approach to the economy and all the rest, I think he has been consistent in an inclusive, non-casting blame, let's do this together tone. And the polls seem to indicate that most people, setting aside the Congress, most actual people feel as if we're moving in the right direction. So there may be some sense of, yes, there is economic light and public health light ahead of us.
Now, let's talk about Republicans, because they're already saying that the tide was already turning in this optimistic, hopeful, positive direction. So in fact, what they are doing is taking the credit for any progress that's been made.
Yes, this is a quite amusing, in human terms, not in partisan terms, in human terms, it's the, you know, the sincerest form of flattery. Say, oh, you know, I had this good idea too. You know, this is, you know, we all voted against your bill, but anyhow, things are getting better already. And so I thought the evening of the speech that Joe Biden gave, Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, was on Judy Woodruff's PBS NewsHour and essentially saying, oh, yeah, the problems are all going away. And he made the interesting argument that the previous COVID bills all had a lot of bipartisan support, and then this one of Joe Biden's was purely partisan. The reason for that is that Democrats in the Senate voted for the bills under Trump, but none of the Republicans in the Senate voted for the bills under Biden. So it was bipartisan before because Democrats were pitching in and the Republicans are not pitching in now. So I think that Joe Biden is playing the long game of, if this is the line of attack, that's actually quite a good situation for Biden to be in. If people saying, yeah, this is a good plan and things are already getting better.
And Mitch McConnell went on to say during that same broadcast, as he has said elsewhere, what is in that bill has only 1% of it dealing with the problem of the illness.
So my understanding is you can argue about that percentage. And if you include all the things for clinics and for schools and all the rest, it is some larger number. But I think that the Biden team would argue back, and I think correctly, that the actual disease is only part of what has happened to the country. What has happened is the closing of downtown businesses and the layoffs of service sector people and just all the polarization of economic inequalities. And so dealing with the disease itself is a necessary condition. That's the beginning of the solution to what has happened, but it's not the entire thing. You have an economy that's been profoundly disrupted. You have children. You have children who've been out of school for a year. You have groups. Every sort of minority group that exists in the United States has been further disadvantaged here. And so, the idea is to deal with the problem in its entirety. So I think I understand why Mitch McConnell was making that argument, but I think there is an argument Biden would make back saying, yes, it's about the larger entirety of what we've been dealing with.
70% of Americans are apparently in favor of this $1.9 trillion package. Does it matter that Republicans in Congress are not in favor of it?
It matters as part of the strange national politics dynamic of this moment, where you have one of our two major parties seemingly not reflecting what appears to be the will of their constituents or the public as a whole. And Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, had a line the last day or two saying that a slogan she was trying to have catch on, which was vote no and take the dough. That is, of having Republican senators and representatives who oppose the bills, then publicizing some of the benefits that would affect their constituents. I believe Senator Wicker of Mississippi put out a press release right after the bill that he opposed passed, saying there's going to be all this rural aid and other things of that sort. So I think it matters if this is dysfunction in our politics. It matters for the evolution of the party. There's one other thing just to mention, Diane, because you and I talked, and you've talked with a million people a dozen years ago. When Barack Obama was trying to do his financial rescue plan back in 2009, right after he took office, and Joe Biden was his vice president, and the main, which only I believe three senators voted for in the end, and it passed, needed a supermajority of Republican senators, and in addition to Republican opposition then, there was a tremendous fear of budget deficits. And that was why it was scaled back to what in retrospect was too small a package. It is amazing how that just doesn't exist anymore. And we'll see whether we have overcorrected, but it really is a dramatic change from a discussion you and I would have been having 12 years ago about the Obama plan.
What about the tax cuts that Republicans put in place? There was no concern about deficits then.
Indeed. And for as a matter of scaling, the Obama rescue plan, they had to be careful to bring in at below $1 trillion because and it was a $600 or $700 billion. It was something like that because there was such political taboo of crossing that line for deficit concerns. Then we skip ahead to the Trump tax cuts, which were about the scale of the stimulus that's just gone through under Biden. That is the close to $2 trillion and very, very heavily skewed to the top of the income distribution. So it was a tax cut. It was about the same scale as what's just gone through for stimulus. It was all at the upper end, and deficits did not seem to matter at that point. Now we have an also very large package, almost $2 trillion, very heavily skewed to the bottom. To the bottom and the middle, the first time in 50 or 60 years that's been the case. And interestingly, you heard Mitch McConnell trying to roll out the grandchildren are going to pay for it argument. It's possible that 5 years from now, this will look like it was doing too much. We don't know. But the tone of debate has changed from 12 years ago with Obama. There's much less talk about budget deficits. Also, there is much less during the Trump tax cuts, but the money's going to very different places now versus 4 years ago.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with James Vallehos. Here's the rest of my conversation with James Vallehos. He's staff writer at The Atlantic. He and his wife, Deborah Vallehos, are the authors of the 2018 book, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America, which was a national bestseller and is the basis of an HBO documentary to be released next month. Now, you and your wife, Deb, have been traveling around the country in your own plane, visiting small towns, and we'll talk about a documentary on that trip in just a bit. But I find myself wondering whether once the benefits of this $1.9 trillion package begin to hit those small-town Americans where you might find a certain number of people represented by those who attacked the U.S. Capitol, do you think minds will begin to change about Trump, what he said, how he argued the election was fraudulent, and how Biden is the legitimate president of the U.S.?
I think this argument about, you know, whether there was a rigged election or a stolen election or who actually is president, I think that's going to be a waning force in our national life. I think that Trump himself is going to be a waning force. And the case that Deb and I were making all along in the articles we were doing and in our book is that this kind of poison that we saw in national level politics was a sort of, in most cases, was a contained thing. If you asked about Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or Joe Biden or Donald Trump, you'd get these really extreme views. But if you talked about most of the other business of people in their states, in their communities, with their school districts, there was something more like normal life still going on. And I think the normal life quotient is going to recover. And just to link this back to the stimulus bill we've been talking about, some things that are particularly sore points in much of rural America, which we've been staying in touch with, rural broadband. That is a real problem in the middle one-third of the country, and there's a big support package for that. Rural health centers also are in bad trouble, and there's support for them. Community colleges, and there being some bolstering of those. And so lots of things that are particularly painful in these communities we're talking about have been specifically addressed in this bill. And I think that as prospects brighten in general, there's kind of and as there's less national level whipping up of hatred, I think the hatred quotient, I hope and believe, will sort of bleach itself out.
Jim, let's take a look at just what is in this stimulus package. the $1,400 stimulus checks, for example, how much will they really help Americans?
So I think what's significant about them and also the extension of unemployment benefits is that the people, there's a lot of people for whom this really is the difference. Being able to meet the rent for the next 2 or 3 months, of being able to have, you know, clothes for schools if kids go back to school, of being able just to cover, to live on the margin. The Atlantic, where I work, had a piece a couple of years ago saying that in terms of just mobilizable cash, of the cash you could come up with in an emergency, the median level in America was something like $1,000 or some small amount of money that most people had as actual cash. So not needing to go to payday lenders, not needing to deal with eviction problems, not needing to just to default on student loan payments. The million other things that are the reality for most American wage earners, these stimulus checks directly address. And since they are phased out on a graduate level, the richest people are not going to get them. But the heart of the benefit is for sort of the median income and below. And so I think that this is the first program in my conscious lifetime where the benefits are skewed to people. The people who have least are getting most. So the people for whom this will make a difference are going to get the money to make a difference. And the people for whom $1,400 they just would save are going to have, that will be sort of phased out by the income level.
And what about the increased child tax credit? Why was that so important?
That is so important because it's the people who have studied the sort of dynamics and sociology and politics of child benefits. Thinking, for example, of our mutual friend Jason DeParle, written for the New York Times and many books, and many others are saying this is actually a revolutionary step in child policy for the United States. It's sort of a step back from Bill Clinton's so-called welfare reforms in the 1990s, which had as an idea that it was better in general to make sure that parents with young children were in the workforce if they could be at all. And that has obvious benefits in having people participate in the workforce, but it seemed to have over time obvious drawbacks for the children themselves. And I think the idea of a child benefit, which many other Western countries have, most other Western countries have, is thinking this is a way simply to address children and families in poverty. And the old question is what's the best way to deal with poverty? Well, money is a way to deal with poverty. And so this gets money into the hands of parents with children just because the children are there and makes the biggest difference to families who need it most.
Now, is there a limit to that child tax credit? Is there a phase-out time limit on that child income tax credit?
So there are different tranches. For children under 6, there's a certain benefit. And then from 6 to 17, and I believe it's a one-year program. Again, the logic of everything that's being applied now is that we're in the middle of an emergency. And as you know, the way of learning from the Obama sort of limited stimulus is it's better to go big immediately and then see what has happened. So the best of my understanding, there are phases for little children, then on through teenage years. So I believe this is a one-year program.
So there has been talk over many decades of providing every family in this country with a minimum income. Is this, or could it be, the beginning of that?
Yes, it could. I'm thinking back when I was in college in the 1960s, one of my professors was Daniel Patrick Moynihan. When I came to Washington in the early 1970s to work for Charlie Peters of the Washington Monthly, Daniel Patrick Moynihan was just publishing a book called The Politics of the Guaranteed Annual Income. He'd been working for Richard Nixon. Nixon had been willing to propose a guaranteed annual income. And this was something that was originally a conservative or at least Republican idea. Milton Friedman was in some ways in favor of a negative income tax, but Nixon was certainly in favor of a guaranteed minimum income. The idea was that it was something that avoided all the detriments of a welfare state. And so We've seen in Stockton, California, over the past 2 years, under Mayor Michael Tubbs, who recently lost a race for re-election, but a very ambitious young mayor in Stockton, has had just guaranteed cash benefits to certain poor families in Stockton. And the result was it seemed to not have any disincentive effect and to improve most measures in Stockton. So that was one test case in one poor California city. The one-year program coming up with a stimulus bill at least is introducing the idea. Some of the opponents are saying, oh, this is nose of the camel underneath the tent. We're going back to hell again. This is socialism. I don't know if Mitch McConnell used the word socialism, but there will be, I'm sure there will be studies saying what is going to be the effect of doing this for a year in time of pandemic, and might this be an experiment worth extending?
What about highways? How will this bill help states, counties, cities across the country deal with highways, bridges, streets falling apart? How much is going there?
So this is one of the least publicized and most important parts of the bill, which is it's what it's doing for state and local governments. And it's a lot of the bill of this $2 trillion is somewhere in the 380, 400, you know, it's maybe a fifth of the entire bill is this aid to state and local governments. The reason this matters so much, of course, is that the state and local tax revenues, not in all cases, but in most, have been very badly hit by, of course, unemployment in their states, by the collapse of local businesses, by just all the other things that have happened in the past year. And state and local governments generally are not able to deficit spend. They are required by state constitutions to balance their budgets. And so many of these places have been going into Herbert Hoover-style descending spirals. As their revenue goes down, they have to cut their spending, which makes the revenue go down further still. And so state and local governments have been pushing very hard to be saying that we need help as much as individuals do through unemployment benefits and through these stimulus checks. This was a very contentious issue between Democrats and Republicans, where Democrats were pushing it and Republicans said, no, 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 we don't want to bail out these states and localities because many of them vote blue, et cetera, which was actually the argument. So this money for state and local governments will be mainly funneled to the things they do best, which includes infrastructure, bridges and highways and roads and airports and train stations and all these things, which have sort of a century's wear on them now. The highways have 60 years wear, the bridges have a century's wear. And we talked often about Infrastructure Week over the past 4 years. This is can be infrastructure year now, or infrastructure decade, because repairing infrastructure gets people to work. It gets right into people's pockets. It builds the basis of further economic growth. So I think the governors and mayors are very, very, very happy to see what this bill has done.
I wonder if this is in some small way a reflection of FDR's efforts to get people back to work as we were trying to come out of a depression. And then, of course, the Second World War hit. Everybody went back to work.
Now, I think that's a great comparison. And I'll just, reminds me of 2 points. One is an entity I forgot to mention in the states and local governments is the tribal governments. You know, Joe Biden went out of his way to mention tribal entities during his speech last night, and they get a disproportionate just as a basis to population, not disproportionate on the basis of need or anything else, but they get a large share for rebuilding their health centers and language programs and preservation in reservations and tribal nations. And so that is one thing that's part of this plan. The other is, I think resonances with FDR are very, very much in the mind of people designing this program at the national level and implementing it for the state and federal governments. Joe Biden is no FDR, and nobody would mistake him as that, and he's not trying to be. But the idea of let's all pull together, let's all get to work, let's all do what we can. I've been in touch frequently with a program called Cal Volunteers, California Volunteers. There's a young man named Josh Friday, who's a military veteran, former mayor of a small town, now the leader of this program, who is modeling what they're doing directly on the old CCC under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Civilian Conservation Corps. California is trying to launch a Climate Conservation Corps to get younger people and older people and retired people and all people enlisted on climate efforts within their state as a model for the country. So I noticed exactly the resonance you're talking about with FDR, New Deal type programs. And I think that is a guiding spirit, both at the national level and at many state levels too.
As you said, Joe Biden is no FDR. Some members of the media have commented on how he leaned forward on the podium last night as though he were really trying to be close to people who were listening and watching. There is something there that's much needed at this point, it would seem to me, about a person demonstrating through those gestures how much he cares.
Oh, Diane, I agree with you and noticed that too. And he also used the phrase, my friends.
Yes.
Which Franklin Roosevelt said. And I think there's one other aspect. You know, Franklin Roosevelt, many of his analyzers and historians, notably including Doris Kearns Goodwin, also a professor of mine in college, have said that, you know, the fact that he had polio made him a different and better person than he could have been otherwise. I think the fact that Joe Biden has had the human losses he's had, and that he is becoming president at this stage of life. He's not the hotshot who was running for president 40 years ago. He's somebody who is the oldest person ever in this office, and he knows he's not going to be there forever, but there is a kind of maturity and warmth that he, I think this equips him for. So I think that is at least what he's trying to do.
One more aspect of the bill, $350 billion in state and local aid and $128.6 billion to help keep kindergarten through 12 schools, help them reopen.
My own children are obviously well past school age, but their children are right in the middle of the closing of the schools. And our grandchildren who live in Texas have been able to go back to schools. They found a way to keep their school open for the last 6 or 8 months with very few breakouts. Our grandchildren who live in California, their schools have still been closed. And the disproportionate damage of school closing on families and children who need it most for the fair chance for their children and for working parents and all the rest has been profound. And so I think that people of every race, every political belief, every part of the country will welcome getting the schools open. So I think getting the vaccine out is a necessary part of that, but all the things it takes to have schools function is also, that should be welcomed in every part of the country.
That was one other criticism on the part of Mitch McConnell, saying there was all this money previously allocated for schools still not used. Was that a fair complaint?
So on the merits, I can't say. What I can say is if you look at and this is something that Biden obliquely, although not so obliquely, mentioned in his speech, that, you know, it's a miracle that all these vaccines were developed under Donald Trump's administration over the past year, but they weren't getting out and the aid wasn't getting out. And the intention of getting things that needed to be done, whether it was highways or schools or vaccines or whatever, the simple execution of getting things done matters a lot. And Jeffrey Zients, whom you know, has being in charge of the vaccination program, that's made a difference in just getting things to the distribution centers. Similarly with the money, I don't know exactly what it has been that has kept the federal government from getting the money to the state governments, but the simple doingness of government is a lot of the non-glamorous change I think we're going through now. And so I think if we're the doingness wasn't happening and seems to be happening now.
So what do you see as the next big priority for the Biden White House? And how hard is it going to be to keep his party together, considering Joe Manchin, and he's not alone in terms of his objections to some elements of what has gone on. He is the driving force behind the removal of that $15 minimum wage.
Yes, it's true that the Democrats have their problems of managing a coalition that stretches from Joe Manchin to Bernie Sanders to, you know, everybody in between. But I think from a historical perspective, it will seem a miracle of unity that all 50 Democrats in that coalition stayed together, and that the minimum wage they gave up, but they found a way to hold this together against unified Republican opposition. And the Republicans, of course, from a historical perspective, have way more serious issues to deal with, of whether Donald Trump or somebody else should be their standard bearer. I think there obviously is a next big decision about this H.R. 1 related bills, of how the Democrats in the House and the Senate deal with the mechanics of governance and of voting and of the filibuster.
With H.R. 1, you're referring to voting around the country.
Yes. Yes, the voting bills. And I think our mutual friend Norm Ornstein has written very incisively about ways to deal with the logjam in the Senate without trying to make Joe Manchin or others give up the filibuster itself. And so I think that will be a front in which they operate. Diane, my guess would be that a lot will depend on just how things in general go over the next 6 months. If the economy is actually improving, if schools are actually opening, if people are actually getting shots, if hospitals are, you know, depopulating in terms of critically ill people, you know, again, a rising tide does lift all the boats and makes people, I'd rather have people arguing over who deserves credit for things getting better than who deserves blame for things getting worse. And I think the most important legislative agenda that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have is simply having conditions improve economically, educationally, and public health terms. If that happens, I think a lot becomes easier. And if it doesn't happen, a lot becomes harder.
What about Donald Trump? Joe Biden doesn't seem to care to talk about him very much. You wrote about this in The Atlantic. What should Joe Biden Democrats be doing in terms of blaming or ignoring? What should their posture be?
From my own perspective, I think Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have played the Trump card perfectly, which is simply not talking about him. That he is, I don't know that Biden has used his name, but he talked about the other guy once or twice, but they are looking forward, not back. So that is them. Meanwhile, there are the mechanics of state and local law enforcement and the attorney generals in New York and California and the Southern District of New York and the prosecutors who are going to be keeping Donald Trump busy, and then he is very much their problem. Then there is the Department of Justice itself, because there are a number of issues that might raise federal prosecution charges. Let's say, for example, did Louis DeJoy tamper with the U.S. mails or not? You know, I have no judgment on that, but that if so, it would be a federal issue. And there, I think what the choice of an attorney general, now confirmed Merrick Garland, who is above reproach and got 20 Republican votes for his confirmation, and who will say, we'll let the machinery of justice take its course. This is not a Republican Department of Justice, not a Democratic Department of Justice. So I think that Joe Biden appointed the right attorney general. That attorney general will appoint the right inspectors general and the right other prosecutors. And the system of blindfolded justice will take its course, and we'll see what happens.
I want to now ask you about the HBO documentary that is coming out next month, on which you and your wife have been working for quite a while. Tell us about it.
So the backstory is that over the past now 7 or 8 years, as you know, I've discussed with you, Deb and I have traveled around mainly to smaller town America in our little propeller plane, mainly giving the narrative that the U.S. looks worst from arm's length and looks best sort of close up. when you can see where the way communities and regions are functioning. And in the year before the pandemic, we went back with an HBO film crew to 6 regions around the country and did 100 days of filming for a really beautiful film that HBO has made, which will come out this spring, and then it'll be running on their streaming service, which delivers a message in beautiful cinematography that I think is appropriate to these times, which is that while the U.S. has been laboring with all of its undeniable crises of public health disaster and economic collapse over the last year, et cetera, and civic tension, there is the same kind of experimental renewal potential city by city around the country that there was, that FDR was able to tap during the Great Depression. You know, during the Great Depression, he said, okay, you Civilian Conservation Corps people, you go out there to Oregon and you go to Oklahoma and you go to Minnesota and you work with the people there. We're going to build something new. And something that like that potential still exists around the country. So we were showing that in Mississippi and in Maine and in Inland Oregon and in West Virginia. So we think the narrative suits the idea that something new is possible again now, we hope.
And again, that was before the pandemic. So I will be looking forward to seeing that documentary, Jim. But I wonder what you think this country has learned in the last year through this awful pandemic.
So I'll give you the minor answer that's connected to our film, then the major answer. The minor answer connected to the film is we argue that the story of almost every part of the country is of repeated blows over the centuries of our existence. Almost any place you go, they've had factories closed down. They have things move in and out. They've had fires. They've had floods. They've had all kinds of things. And actually, the essence of the U.S. story is response to disasters and finding ways to sort of deal with that resilience in the family level, the community level, et cetera. For the country as a whole, I hope, something I think we seem to have learned even without mentioning it, it does matter that we have functioning ways to deal together. A public health service actually matters. Having a way to make vaccines actually matter. Finding ways to deal with the public well-being actually matters. And that the ways in which those collective needs have become politicized, that's to the bad. And I hope we can avoid that. I was seeing a little video by Neil deGrasse Tyson, the famed scientist, yesterday, a day or two ago. He said, like, having ideas of places where you do and don't wear masks is like saying, okay, this is the peeing area of the swimming pool. You know, we're all in the swimming pool. We're all, the masks affect everybody. So I would hope that with the passage of time, there will be some sense of usness again that will come from this disaster, even though the harm was very much not us. I mean, it was certain groups of our community, of our nation, bore disproportionate burdens, that frontline healthcare workers and minority communities and older people all were disproportionately suffering. But as the suffering spread, I think there may have been some, I hope there'll be some awareness of the usness of the national culture and the need for a functioning, there are ways in which we have figured out how to work together and live together, and maybe that will remind us of that message, I hope.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you for being with us. Congratulations on the upcoming documentary. I'm sure we'll all be looking out for that. Thanks so much for being with us.
Diane, it's always an honor and pleasure to talk with you, and I'll be watching for your documentary too.
Thank you. That was James Fallows. He's staff writer at The Atlantic. He and his wife, Deborah Fallows, are the authors of the 2018 book, Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. And that's all for today. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Rohde. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Before we go, I want to share the news of Roger Mudd's death this week. has been a great loss to the world of journalism and to me personally. He was a dear friend and mentor and one of the finest journalists I've ever known. He will be greatly missed. Thanks for listening, all. Stay well. Take care. I'm Diane Rehm.